This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Hello and welcome to the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. This is episode 31. I'm talking about whether game design writing has, to some extent, seemed to curve off in the last few years, and a few other topics. I'm going to be talking about wins and losses in games. I'm going to be talking about permadeath a little bit. And if there's time at the end, I want to talk a little bit about this idea of a connection that people have between the idea of social progress and being against theory and science to some extent. So yeah, let's start with this idea of the collapse of game design writing. And this is something I noticed. I just noticed this a few weeks ago that I was kind of like thinking like, because, you know, what started it was I kept harping on about Frank Lance's work in a lot of my stuff. And part of that's because I've talked about why. You know, he and I, like, we know each other. We talk a lot. We actually do share the same viewpoint on a lot of stuff. And so he's kind of the perfect person to, like, argue with. Because a lot of people that you would want to argue with, you just don't even have the same foundation to even begin a conversation. And I've experienced that being the case with most game designers that I talk to. So that's why I always keep going back to him. But also I was thinking, like, well, okay, who else would I want to, you know, rebuke, or who else would I want to maybe have on the podcast? What I really like, and maybe you guys can find me some examples of this, is game design bloggers or whatever, or podcasts, it could be in any format, coming out and making some kind of claim about game design. And I'm going to talk about one of them that I found today or recently. But in general, if you can find me people like that, I'd love to have people like that on the show, have them explain their point of view, and then have a discussion about it. The problem is, and this is because I've been thinking about, like, oh, I want to have people like that on the show, is that from my vantage point, and granted the internet's a huge place and it's very hard to know this kind of thing, but from what I can tell, there's not a lot of people doing that. And also that's a change from 5 years ago. So I wanted to talk about, I have this list of these blogs that used to write consistently about game design. And they don't anymore, really. The biggest one, the one I'm going to start with, is The Lost Garden by Dan Cook. So he used to be, in fact, he's my inspiration. He was my inspiration back in like the mid-2000s for getting into writing about game design. His stuff around that era, the 2000s, was very inspiring for me. And I happen to know that also David Serlin felt the exact same way. When we met at practice in 2011, we talked about how we both like saw his blog and we wanted to do what he did. But, you know, I mean, I think, let me just check real quick. In 2015, he wrote one article that's like arguably tangential to game design. It's more about marketing. In 2014, he wrote a couple of articles, but I mean, nothing in 2016. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, that's one person, but he's also a very influential and very, for me at least, a very inspirational person. And so that got me kind of like thinking about some of these other writers that have always been inspirational. And so, yeah, that's a small thing. Maybe, who knows, you know, maybe something's going on in his life and he just, yeah. You know, I've had conversations with him and I think that he is actually more interested these days in talking about social things and talking about marketing things, business things, maybe not quite as much about like arguing about. In fact, one of his last articles that he wrote about game design is 5 conversations about game design I ignored, you know, and he goes on about these things that he thinks are stupid conversations. And, you know, to some extent, they are. I agree. Some of them I totally disagree. They're stupid conversations. But I think sort of implicit in that is in that piece, which I'll link in the show notes, is this idea that, like, you know, it's kind of stupid to talk about game design. I don't think he meant it that way, but I do think that that is a meme that exists somewhere in the minds of people that sort of influences things a little bit. Another writer that that I used to love a lot is Anna Anthropy. Her website is called, I believe it's still called, Anti-Pixelanti. phenomenal writing. Back in the day, it was another one of my huge inspirations. I remember she had this thing, To the Right, Hold On Tight. It was a piece about Super Mario Brothers' silent tutorial of the first level. And it was just really smart. It was like really clear and functional. And yeah, it was just very direct. It wasn't like arty or anything. It was very just, here's exactly how this works. Here's what you could possibly be doing this with your games, etc. And from what I can tell, she's also been done with writing about game design since about 2014. So that's a weird thing. There's a 2014 there pattern already. Also, Tig Kelly, I believe I'm pronouncing his name properly. Forgive me if I'm not. He wrote a blog called What Games Are. And he used to write articles that were like very, you know, kind of like the kind of stuff I write. Game design, unpacky, very mechanical and that kind of stuff. And he's apparently been done since 2014. Lost Garden, I mentioned already. I just have a list here. I wanted to start with the Lost Garden, though, because it was so influential to me. David Serlin, he's also been done writing about game design since about 2014. Now, he has a podcast, too, so that's kind of an exception, and that's something I'll talk about a little bit later. But, you know, it's possible that maybe just all of his game design thoughts are now just going to the podcast, and that's fine. But I do think there's still something to be said about the articles going away. There might be something to look at there. Games with Garfield is Richard Garfield's articles, and they apparently are done since 2012. Soren Johnson, he's the designer of like Civ 4 and a bunch of other stuff. Now he's Offworld Trading Company is his latest game, and he's been done since 2013. Now he also has a podcast, but it's not a very like game designy podcast. It's more like let's chat with game designers, people who happen to be game designers. But from the episodes I've listened to, it's not like this podcast. It's not like, you know, let's get into the nitty gritty and fight about what, you know, what makes good game design and that kind of stuff, which is fine. I actually like his podcast a lot. It's just, it isn't the kind of stuff that he used to write. It's not a replacement for that. Richard Terrell's blog, Critical Gaming, was his first one. And then he switched over in, I think, 2014 to Design Oriented, which at first seemed to be like kind of a game design-y blog sort of thing that he was doing with other people, but recently has been switching over to being this tool that we talked about on the show. Go back and listen to the Richard Terrell episodes to hear more about that. It's very cool stuff, and it definitely influences game design writers, and it's a very important thing that he's doing, but I think it's safe to say that since about 2014, again, with him, there's been a sharp curve off of writing articles about game design. Those are the big people that I think of in terms of game design writing, at least in English. Now, I'm sure there are others. I'd love to hear your suggestions in the comments. Please let me know about them. But in at least in the ones that I'm aware of, and there maybe this is just revealing something about my own experience that like I've stopped looking for such things or, you know, something like that. There's I have recently since I've been making this observation, I've been like looking, and I should also mention I run I'm a moderator on the Reddit /r/game design subreddit. And I see what gets posted and what people talk about and what goes up there. And there's more in the way of like videos. Videos seem to be a big thing. So now it could just be that that there's just a, you know, shifting from articles to videos and podcasts. That's possible. I'll talk a little bit about that in a second. But in general, I'm not finding any like new Dan C's or new David Serlins or new Tide Kelly or whatever, or new people like myself that are doing the kinds of stuff I'm doing, at least as consistently and prolifically as those people did back in the day. There's a few other websites I'll just mention. NickDavidson.com, he stopped in 2011. Dan Klein. He has a WordPress blog that he stopped in 2013. Design Inside Out, Design Side Out, it's called, another blog, done since 2013. Game Design Theory, gamedesigntheory.blogspot.co.uk, done since 2014. So these are just like a bunch of little sites that I found that were game design blogs but are now defunct since about the last 5 years, somewhere in there. Which sort of supports my theory that something's happening, I think, in the last few years. I should mention quickly, there are other writers that are writing sort of tangentially about game design. Like there's this one famous aspect who writes about like monetization and that kind of stuff. There's a lot of those. But in terms of like, how are we going to build good rule sets? It's actually pretty hard to find people who consistently write about that, in my experience. And I'm super, if someone comes along and gives me a huge list of, no, here's all the people that are doing this, I will be so happy to see that. That'd be great. I would love to be wrong about this. But this is my observation. And you know what? Worst comes to worst, this reveals something about my own perception and something, you know, something like that. So yeah, books. It's a little hard to say with books because, you know, I was tempted to say, oh, all the top game design books came out between like 2000 and 2012, 2013, something like that. But they're also pretty sparse. Like the big game design books are also like, there's only like one or two a year at best anyway. Sometimes one every other year. So to say like, oh, in the last two or three years, there hasn't been any big books like that, feels kind of cheap because that's not really a big enough space of time. Now, if we don't get, I can actually think of at least Naomi Clark, the book that she worked on last year, 2015, and of course my own book. So yeah, I mean, books is hard to say. It seems like books are always kind of sparse, but they're kind of consistent. Now we'll see. I mean, maybe we won't see as many books in the next few years, but I don't really see a sign of that lulling yet. So videos definitely are on the uptick, it seems to me. I do see more like, you know, of these like sort of blogger types making these YouTube series about game design. And that's good. And I don't mind if we're switching mediums from articles to game design. I do think it's good if we have two videos. I do think it's good if we have both. I think there are certain things that articles really lend themselves to, and which is why I continue to write articles as well as doing this podcast and video series. So yeah, and another little piece of tangential, or not tangential, but sort of circumstantial piece of evidence is that it's pretty hard to find good content for my subreddit, Game Design. We do find things, but a lot of submissions are just off topic, like a lot of them. And yeah, it just seems a little bit sparse still, which is weird because we actually have a lot of followers. It's a big subreddit, but it seems kind of hard to get real on topic content. So, you know, if you're someone who listens to this, please come by the Game Design subreddit and submit some stuff and have a conversation. It's a good place to get that going. That's what I've been trying to do for a few years, but it's, you know, it's difficult. So, I don't know, if any of this is true, I feel like it's because game design is inherently kind of hard to talk about. It's a little bit, like, loose. It's very loose right now, especially. And I think there was, like, this weird bubble in the 2000s, mid-2000s, and I think that the rise of, like, indie games actually really spurred that on. Like, the whole, you know, when Braid came out, late 2000s, and there was this idea that, like, oh my god, like, indie game developers are like, they can just make these amazing experiences, these amazing things, and so because of that, we should be, like, thinking about, like, you know, we should be thinking about game design, and not just that, but, like, indie game design writers can also be, like, really influential and important and stuff, and I feel like that idea has kind of been melting away with the idea that, like, indies, you know, maybe the indie thing wasn't quite what we thought it was. Like, maybe it's not quite as promising as we had hoped. And so with that, sort of maybe went the writing a little bit. And, you know, one thing to just add to this, and this might just be, again, my bias kind of coming through, but I've sort of felt this thing myself. Like, I felt, you know, back in 2010, 2011, 2012, 2013, And even to 2014, I felt extremely inspired to write about game design. I mean, I wrote two books on the topic. I started a video game, a game design video series. I was extremely, and I still am, like, you know, pretty prolific about it, but I've definitely noticed in myself, like, things sort of curving off. And you know what? Maybe that's all this podcast will add up to being, is just I'm seeing something in myself, and then I'm like, sort of finding the patterns online in terms of other people writing. But you know, maybe not. You tell me what you think. And I realize that's kind of loose and kind of not a very strong case. But you know, I do think there's a lot of these big writers who were writing a lot before, and they don't seem particularly interested in writing, and I think there's something to explore there. Okay, so this is like a potpourri show, so I'm going to be like kind of switching topics sort of, you know, halfway through. Here is my second topic. So this is totally unrelated to the first thing. Still working on the transitions, in case you didn't notice. The importance of wins and losses in games. So, hate to do this, but going back to a Frank Lance thing, he actually came to the Dino Farm forums, which is pretty cool, and started arguing with us about game design stuff. So he's there at Dino Farm. You could be too. I'd love to have you. I do think that the Dino Farm forums has as good conversations on game design as just about anywhere. So I really recommend people come by there, or at least read, lurk. So anyway, Frank, we were talking about wins and losses in games, and we were talking a little bit about the win rate thing. If you've read my other work or heard my other podcast, you know that my position is that games should strive to have a win rate of 50% for anyone that's playing the game. So with a multiplayer game, you achieve that by having a matchmaking system. But with a single player game, you achieve that by having a dynamic difficulty adjustment system, as in exemplified in Oro. And the reason for that is, well, I'll get back into the reason for that is, but I want to start with a quote from Frank Lance that he posted on the forum as we were having a discussion about this. Because somebody actually asked this sort of, I think of it as like kind of like a little bit of like a testing the edges question of like, Frank, do you think that a game needs to have a win rate between 1% and 99%? And just testing to see if, you know, a 0 or 100% game would be acceptable to him. And he said, I think it would be perfectly possible to design a beautiful game, my favorite word, with a, quote, win rate of 0% or 100%. What matters is how difficult and interesting it is to find the right move. And he put find the right move in italics. And I wrote a response to that, which I will read now, and I will also unpack. Kind of go into it a little more. I wrote, this view is actually to me a reflection of our resistance to structure in game design. Structure scares us because we don't know how to make functional structures, or what it would even mean for a structure to function. So we operate at the level of moves. Again, that's the thing that Frank had in italics. Find the right move. Going on reading the comment more. Even many of the best designers just think about this current move right now. That's what enables them to say stuff like, quote, output randomness is just input randomness for the next turn. Basically, each turn is its own self-contained game. We're basically designing one-turn game generation machines. That's why people are able to say this stuff about wins and losses not mattering, because in today's games, the win-loss is just some arbitrary point that the system stops spitting out one-turn games, and I have to reset it for some reason. So I hope that's sort of I made that clear. Like, when you look at games as just a series of decisions, like a list of decisions, then yes, that's true. The win rate doesn't matter at all. I don't even know why you would have a win or a loss at all, really. I mean, you could set it up in such a way that that you don't even need a win or loss to do that. But the difference is, it's kind of like the difference between a list of events and a story. Okay, so right now we are operating with game design in list of events mode. And I'm proposing that we could be doing stories, things where every decision informs the next decision in a logical way that heads somewhere and that means something, that has a charge and a value and that's going somewhere. And that's the structure that I talk about. And so, anyway, let me finish my quote. And that works, but it's extremely limiting. Imagine if instead all the turns combined as part of a large whole and became something larger than just the sum of them. That would be embracing structure, holistic game design. And I believe that that's the next step in strategy game design. So, yeah, that's just a kind of a point I wanted to harp on. I think that's really important. I think that's like, until we get there, we just can't really do much. Almost everything I try to talk about with game design is reliant on this. This way of looking at games as a whole structure and not just a list of decisions. So that's all pretty much all I have to say about that. But that actually does segue into the next topic that I want to talk about, because I read this article called, and it's by someone named Draken. And this is partly because I've been looking for people writing about game design. And Draken wrote this on just 2 days ago, October 16. Today it's the 18th. And it's called Grinding is Dead. Skinner Boxes Are Dead. All Hail Permadeath. And his general, let me just read the conclusion section to this article. Quote, I feel very deeply that permadeath is a powerful and strong mechanic that produces some beautiful experiences. But that, like experience points and loot drops and idling before it, it has been twisted into a ubiquitous content-extending force that has ultimately served as a cheap shortcut for turning small games into big ones. All right, so I'm going to stop right there real quick. So his basic premise, which I completely agree with, is that roguelikes are basically super shallow. He has an example in here about like, oh, do I drink this potion or that potion? I drink this one. Oh, it killed me. Now I just have to like start over again. And yeah, that's absolutely true. The permadeath thing is just an artificial way to extend and to basically extend out a system that's not deep and that's not interesting. It creates this like life toll where you go here. It's like door A, B, and C, and you pick door A. Nope, wrong door. Now go all the way back to the beginning, and then you have to wait a long time before you can get back to door A, B, and C again. Door A, B, and C. Pick B. Nope, go all the way back to the beginning. So it's this big process of just lengthening an issue that or a system that's inherently not deep. Now, here's where I sort of disagree with this writer, because it comes off to me as, let me go on with reading and then I'll respond. Quote, in the process, these have all been responsible for turning small, good games into big, wasteful games, not just wasteful of the time of players, but also wasteful of the potential of that small game that could have been something great. So that's where we disagree. The issue is that they're taking a small bad game that if people just knew what the actual stuff to learn in a roguelike was, and it was made very quick and efficient for them, they would quickly dismiss it. What they're doing is they're putting up a smoke screen of this time, and randomness does this, and content does this, asymmetry to some extent does this. It's one of these smoke screens to avoid people, to like keep people from realizing how bad the system is for as long as possible. So it's not that they take small good games and put them into big wasteful games. It's that they take small bad games that would be very obviously bad and make them into big bad games that people don't really figure out are bad for a lot longer. Or ever, sometimes. Because they create these like illusions, basically. They're based on these illusions. And maybe I should unpack that a little bit more. If you put a big delay, and by delay I mean having to play through the, just sort of grind your way through the first 5-6 levels. Like, let's say, at the level 10 of the dungeon in Dungeon Crawl or any roguelike or whatever, there's this thing you don't really know how to solve. There's this new monster, and you're like, oh, I don't know if it's immune to fire magic or ice magic, and I only have a couple turns to deal with him, so I'm going to try this. So you climb all the way down the dungeon, you try it, it's wrong. And you're like, okay, and I died. And now you have to start all the way over and do it again with something different. It's trial and error. And it's basically, the thing is, if right in the beginning of the game, you could find out, you know, like if there wasn't this long delay between you and even testing these hypotheses, you'd be like, all right, this is dumb. I'm just, you know, trial and error. It's like it becomes too obvious that it's not a deep system, that you're just trying to put this, you know, square peg into the square hole, and people would give up on it much faster. But that delay of having to grind your way through the 10 levels or whatever creates this illusion. You sort of forget that, oh, it all just came down to I guessed wrong between A, B, and C, and I didn't know, you know, which exact specific recipe that they wanted me to follow. So that's where I disagree with this writer. Now, there's further things I should just mention. He goes on, quote, decrying permadeath or roguelites in any game in particular, or any game in particular, isn't my goal here and is hardly going to solve anything. That's like the worst thing. I hate that people write that kind of stuff so much. Why would it be bad to decry permadeath? Maybe permadeath is bad. What if permadeath is a bad thing? Or any game in particular? What if some game is bad? And how is that not going to solve anything? I think that part of a solution is removing options, you know? Part of a solution is deduction. And so decrying certain things, saying this design pattern is kind of bad, or saying it's, you know, it tends to be bad at least, or it tends to have these problems, helps us kind of deduce the right way to go. So it absolutely does help us solve things. I'm going to finish the article because this is the conclusion section. Quote, all I want is to play more games that are more thoughtful about what goes into them, especially gating mechanics that demand time and devotion without offering the same in return. So that's where I think that he and I agree. I think he's sort of like hinting at that he wants a deep system, a system that's actually deep and that has something to learn for players and is not just a big illusion. So anyway, I wanted to respond to that article. I've talked a lot about permadeath. I used to have an article up about permadeath. I took it down because it's old and it really needed to be rewritten. I will mention quickly about my thoughts about permadeath. I think that the concept of death in games is very harmful. And of course there is the, you know, on a social level, it's probably kind of harmful to have death be this verb that we just sort of throw around cavalierly. But that's even totally that aside, just mechanically. The problem with the concept of death is that it ties game over state with game lost state in a way that's harmful for game design. You most of the time you wouldn't necessarily want that. Game designers need to be free to work with other game end triggers. Like maybe there's a timer. That's not one of my favorites, but that's one possibility. Maybe there's some resource that builds up, and when it builds all the way up, that ends the game. Maybe, you know, when you collect three things, that's what ends the game. Look to Euro games and how many crazy different kinds of victory conditions they have. Some examples. The death at the very least, the death meme in game design is extremely limiting. So that's my problem with death in general. There's a lot of times when you would want the player, in fact, in Oro, it is totally possible to die and win on the same turn, because the point of the game is to get a certain amount of points. Death is the game end trigger. Now, usually when you die, that, you know, it, you wouldn't just so happen to have reached the score goal that turn. So usually death in Oro does mean loss, but they're not explicitly tied together. And I think that's something game designers need to think about. And then in terms of the perma, yeah, it's just, it's, I agree with this article, Draken's article. It's basically just a way of extending the life of a extremely shallow system and making players, it's just, you know, it's grinding. It's basically a new way to put grinding in front of, it's like RPGs, it's the same thing. You have some really dumb challenges, but let's just put a bunch of grinding in front of it, and that labor kind of makes people forget. It sort of puts them into like a kind of like trancy state, you know, it sort of disassociates them from the stuff that they're actually doing a little bit. So that's my thoughts on permadeath. Okay, so I have one more topic to get into. Looks like I'm on track time-wise. Okay, so there's two ideas. One idea is the idea that, you know, that we can actually come up with answers. This is something I talk about all the time, that that we can solve problems, that we can do things better than we did 10 years ago, 5 years ago, yesterday, by proposing solutions, and that we can do this in the arts. That the arts are not immune, they're not this magical realm that doesn't respond to reason. What they are is a more complex realm than maybe anything else that we deal with, and a more difficult problem to solve. But that doesn't mean that we can't, and we haven't, solved those problems. So that's idea one. Okay, idea two is this concept that the world as we know it, the world that we operate in, is this very like Western dominated, white male dominated culture that, you know, like the victors sort of wrote history and sort of dictated reality, the terms of reality. They put what's in our textbooks, and everything about our society is sort of inherently geared towards, in some ways, you know, the male experience, and you know, people have been talking about this with this election and with Hillary Clinton, and how, you know, a lot of how she's not perceived as a great speaker may just be sort of a gendered kind of thing. I mostly agree with that. And, you know, there's a lot of ideas that we just, I think, take for granted that are very sort of male dominated, Western, certainly Western dominated. I mean, culture was like taken over by like Western European values, I feel like, in the last, you know, couple hundred years, and only more so in the last 20, 30, 50 years. So that's true. That's idea number two. And I think that that is true. And I think that, you know, people who are socially progressive need to remember that. And they need to, people like myself who are like white, Western males, you know, cishet guys, need to recognize that they are, in so many ways, things are built sort of for them. And that's totally true. But what I wanted to say is that idea two and idea one can live completely in harmony together. You know, like, I don't think there's any conflict there. So the reason I bring this up is because I've met a few people, especially in academia, who, and by the way, I should say I'm not talking about Frank Lance right now, because I know I've been picking on him a lot. This is not who I'm talking about. There's other people, several people that I've heard speak, and that I've just talked to over the years, who take this attitude that things that, you know, things that go, one of the things that belongs in category two is category one, meaning like category one is a subset of category two. The idea of progress and science and, you know, reason, those are even like male dominated, you know, patriarchal values that we need to like get rid of. So I've not zero times, I don't know the exact number, but some number of times I've proposed some kind of criteria, or, you know, some theory or whatever for game design, how we can make better games. And it has come back at me that like an answer that's sort of like, well, it's easy for you to say that, you know, you're like a white guy. Like, I'm unaware of the privilege that I have to be able to propose that, and that inherently just like the values of like reason and stuff are these patriarchal Western values that that we just sort of accept for no reason, like that are, you know, in the same way that we accept like sexist ideas and racist ideas and various like cultural concepts that I agree we do accept for bad reasons. But to put reason itself in there and to put progress itself in there is something that I've witnessed before. And I just think that it's worth sort of pushing back on. Now, I'm very uncomfortable. The reason I'm kind of like stuttery about this is because I'm very uncomfortable in general with the idea of doing the thing. I've talked about this before about doing the whole, oh, but not that sort of thing with social progress movements. And, you know, for example, like there's a lot of people in the last 10 years who were like, all right, I'm fine with gay people, but trans people, come on. You know, that's going too far. And so I don't want to be doing that. I don't want to be by saying like, well, no, let's keep science and let's keep reason. Let's just do a better job of it and make sure that it's not biased and make sure that we're not sort of having these implicit, like if we have implicit biases in science, let's point those out and let's fix them. I mean, that's part of what science is. And granted, I'm sure that that science fields and, you know, philosophy and aesthetics are all dominated by guys. You know, I'm sure that's true. And I'm sure there are biases there that need to be unpacked. But the answer is to do that. So let's do that work of unpacking those biases, not throwing out the entire concept of technical progress. So I guess what I'm saying is, social progress and technical progress can continue to advance together. There's no inherent conflict there. Where there are conflicts, we just need to work them out. We need to figure out, like, where's the bias happening? Where's the error? Basically, we just need error correction. So that's something I wanted to say. I think to a lot of people, that's going to sound... So there's going to be, like, most people who hear this are going to be like, oh, that's like totally straw man-y, weird. Like who would ever say such a thing? And I agree with that sentiment. And, you know, if this section was sort of boring to you for that reason, I apologize. But I swear it's something that I've dealt with numerous times. I could probably think of 3 times off the top of my head. There's probably been more that have happened. And the fact that they've happened means, when they did happen, they were from somewhat influential people. So I just think that's something to sort of have on your radar. Maybe you'll experience it and maybe you'll think about this. Maybe not. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe actually, you know, talk to me about this. Maybe I'm doing that thing where I'm like, oh, they're going too far, the social progress people. Let me know. I mean, I would like to hear the case for that. I'm not convinced of that, but I would like to hear that case. I doubt I will hear that case. But so anyway, kind of a potpourri show. I hope that you enjoyed it. Please let me know what you thought and post some stuff in the comments. And thank you again for listening. And I will catch you next time. This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.